This is Main Street on Prairie Public from the Red River Valley to the Badlands. This is a virtual meeting place like the Main Streets across the state. We come together and we greet our friends and we talk about what's on our minds. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up later on the show, we're going to hear from horticulturist Ron Smith, who is getting us ready. How many of you out there have spring fever? Well, he's going to help you channel some of that into getting your garden going for the year. But we're going to start today with a young artist, Amanda Eldweek. She is based in Watford City, and she writes the comic Amanda the Great, which you can read at gocomics.com, and you can just search Amanda the Great there. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and thank you for calling me young. That's really cool.
Well, you know, young Amanda appears in the comic strip an awful lot.
Yeah, she does, yeah. Very young Amanda.
How do you describe Amanda the Great?
It's just a comic strip about my life, and it's mostly autobiographical. There are pieces of it that are fictional, like my younger self doesn't really obviously appear to me, but I use it in the strip, just kind of as an antagonist sort of character. But I kind of started the strip off about the time that my husband, presently, when we were engaged, and it just kind of chronicles our life, and it is set 4 years. The timeline is about 4 years prior to right now. So it's just kind of 4 years behind present day.
Why'd you pick that time period?
When I had started drawing it seriously, that's kind of the time period I started, and that happened to be 4 years prior to that time. I just kind of wanted to go back a little ways and kind of tell our story, I guess, Dan and I. So
are you basing this entirely on memory? Do you have little doodles or even a journal that you reference?
Yeah, some of it's memory. My memory, sometimes I'm kind of a poor historian, so I do have to write things down. And I have a little book, and I use social media. I go back in Facebook and kind of, you can look at different years and things you wrote, and then it kind of triggers a memory, like, oh, that happened, or a photo that I posted, and I'll make copious notes in this book, and now that I'm aware that I have to do that, I'm trying to keep track of our present life so that 4 years from now I'm not going to have to remember it.
So you want to keep doing this? You're at least looking 4 years down the road.
Yeah. At least, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Do you consider yourself a writer first or an illustrator first, or can you only ever be both if you're doing comics?
I think you have to be both. To be fair, though, there's some comics that don't use words at all. They rely on images, and I think that's a big talent to have to convey a thought with just purely image and no writing. But I think as a cartoonist, I think you have to have both as a strong game.
Yeah.
So I consider myself a cartoonist, and I guess that does entail both pieces of, yeah, the art piece and the writing piece. So
how long had you been drawing or scribbling and making little notes before it turned into a comic strip?
Been drawing comics since I was real young, and you know, a kid can cook up, you know, and stuff, but I mostly just kept sketchbooks and didn't really seriously make, like, I would, you know, not in a strip format, but most of my life I've been doing that and stuff, and I seriously only started maybe trying to compile them sequentially in the last maybe 5 or 6 years or so. Mm. And and stuff. So,
do you get to do an edit on these then? Like, is there a moment that definitely happened 4 years ago that you don't want to admit anymore, so you just get to admit it from the comic strip?
Yeah, it's kind of nice. I can rewrite history, kind of, I guess, if I wanted to, sure. Yeah, there's some things I mean, if it's, you know, if it's embarrassing or something that happened to me, it's kind of nice because you can write it to kind of take the sting out of it. So if you can make a joke out of something embarrassing, it kind of makes it better for me in some ways. But there are some things I don't put in the comic strip on purpose because, you know, some things are too personal or they're not mine to tell.
Yeah.
You know, like the other characters that are in my life and stuff. So
does your husband ever get to dictate what goes into these comics or more specifically what gets left out of the comics?
Yeah. I mean, I do. There are some things where in some things I probably should run by him and don't, but, I will ask him, you know, do you think this is appropriate? You know, is this something that you want in there? And if he doesn't, I won't put it in there. And if I upload it and, you know, he's like, well, I don't know, you know, I can go back and change it. I mean, it's, you have to, you know, re-upload it and stuff, but I do try to consider, you know, him and ask him, you know, if it's something that pertains to him or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comic strip, and again, it's called Amanda the Great, and you can find it at gocomics.com, and we are visiting with cartoonist Amanda L. Dweek, and she lives in Watford City. And the comic, it's very relatable. There's this strip where you're both in bed, and you're clearly wide awake, and you're thinking about all the kinds of things that come, at least to a woman's head, in the middle of the night. And, you know, there's this, what if we can't have kids? And then your husband's, well, then we'll have them a different way. And then you seem okay, and then you just immediately ask if you can get more cats. And I've totally done that.
The answer is usually no.
Yeah, I get the one cat per 1,000 square feet answer a lot. And so then I'm just like, so we need a bigger house? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Well, there's a chance.
Do you hear back? You know, I noticed on the website that there is some interaction there. Do you get the most feedback when they seem really relatable or when they seem, you know, more outrageous, like when you're trying to breed a horse and a lion or whatever you're daydreaming about at work?
the stuff that gets the most feedback lately has seemed to be today is one of them, where I've mentioned a musical band that I like or, you know, something like that where people are like, oh, I love them and you should listen to, you know, this band and I saw these guys, you know, in concert, blah, blah, blah. And anytime, you know, sometimes like the lion and horse one, yeah, you know, I always think like this, like I drew this thing and, you know, this hybrid of those, and this, you know, this will really wow them. And those are the ones where you don't get the comments that you think you're going to get. And then you know, I'll post something that I'm like, you know, this is just, you know, nothing special. I don't think, you know, I mean, it's, you know, and then people just really take off and they comment on it. And it's kind of odd that way. Cause it's always like, this is going to get a lot of comments and it won't. And then, you know, I don't know.
So what does that tell you about your readers or at least the power of a comic strip?
You know, as a cartoonist, you kind of have a different view of your comics or comics in general and what's good to you as a cartoonist versus what's good to people who don't draw comics but like to read comics. And it's, you know, sometimes they're looking for something else, you know, that sometimes you'll provide it, sometimes you won't. But I think we as cartoonists, you know, often think like this is good on this because of this reason, but it's not the same reason why somebody else would like it. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
People like what they like. You know, I mean, if you happen to mention something they like, you know, I think that really engages them, and that might, you know, lead them into reading other strips too. So that's, you know, it's helpful.
Sure. Do you read other people's comic strips, especially specific to the site that you publish on, gocomics.com?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you read the comics on GoComics, there's a button that says follow. And you can follow comics, and then they organize them. You can go up to a tab, I think it says My Comics, and the comics I follow. And then they'll organize, if you follow all these different comics, they'll organize them for you. So you can just click that every day and read them sequentially, like you would read a newspaper. So yeah, I have a bunch that I follow, and there's probably a bunch more on there that I want to read and follow. There's so many that it's hard to read them all, because it takes me about an hour to read the ones I have, you know.
Yeah, so, I had to unsubscribe from a lot of podcasts because I thought I don't have this. There's not that much time in a day.
There's just so much good stuff out there. It's hard to read it all, you know.
Yeah, what would you say is the role of the internet in terms of being able to publish your work and get it out there for comics for a cartoonist?
I think the internet's been a real boon for us. But as far as getting your stuff out there, but also a lot of times when you put your stuff out there, you know, not necessarily in my case, but if you have, you know. If you're just posting on social media, you know, you're kind of giving it away, you know, and that's kind of tricky too. I mean, you want people to read your stuff and get a following, but sometimes there's a price for it, you know, if you're going to charge people to read stuff, they're not going to read it. They want to read everything for free. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think it's been good in some ways because, I mean, everybody can get online and put their comic on either social media or their own website or a hosting. There's a sites that host specifically for web comics, and that's good. But you know, there's also the issue of, you know, you're still doing this and not able to make really a living from it.
Yeah. Are you able to make any money from this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yep.
Okay. Is the goal to make a lot of money from this or just to, you know, just to do it, to put it out there?
For me specifically or just in general?
For you specifically.
Well, everybody wants to be able to make a living doing what they like. And I certainly would like that and stuff. But, you know, I you do it because you like doing it and you like the laughs you get and you know, people taking time to read your work is really a high compliment, you know, and because, you know, you can scroll through and just miss things and, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's good, but people just gloss over it. And if they take the time to read it, that's really neat. You'd like to make a living from it, you know, a real decent living, but it's tricky. You know, I think it's a lot more tricky now.
Young Amanda makes an appearance in a lot of your comics. And, you know, the way that a younger version of yourself can be so obnoxious. And sometimes she's sort of prodding you about things going on in your current life. Do you have advice for young Amanda?
Well, and tell her that don't be in such a hurry to grow up. I when I was young, you wanted to get bigger, so yeah, you can do what I want, and you know, nobody can tell me what to do. And then you grow up, and you're like, there's more people telling me what to do, and there's responsibilities and bills and things, you know. But yeah, that's what I would tell her.
We're visiting with Amanda Eldweek. She is the creator of Amanda the Great. You can read it at gocomics.com. There's a search function there, and you can just search Amanda the Great. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Coming up next on Main Street, we have an essay from Alan Kleinsaucer.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
It doesn't need to be a dark and stormy night to see Agatha Christie's iconic play, and then there were none. at the Fire Hall Theater. Theatergoers can guess who done it March 15th through the 31st. For those who want dinner and a show on Fridays, theatergoers may enjoy fish, chips, and a pint. More information on either or both at 777-4090.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Alan Jack Kleinsaucer is the author of a 2-volume memoir of his life in the Dakotas. There are a series of short essays and glimpses into life in the past. He recorded a few of these essays for us, and today we hear one called Long Way From Home about traveling in North Dakota during World War II.
One summer we went to Lincoln Valley, which was a small town about 40 miles from home. Back in those days, people did not go too far from home, so this would be quite a trip for us. My dad had a 1934 Chevy four-door sedan. I think my mom wanted to go and see a lady that lived there. She was kind of a chiropractor lady. Her name was Mrs. Fry. At this time, the war was still going on, and tires were hard to get. As luck would have it, we got a flat tire on our way home from Lincoln Valley. It was a hot summer day, and we had no spare tire to use. Well, after waiting a while, a man came by and took my dad to the county seat, which was Fessenden, North Dakota. He had to go to the courthouse to get an okay to go buy a new tire. Mom, my brothers, and myself had to wait in the car all afternoon until Dad came back with a new tire so we could go home. We got home kind of late that day and had to do all of the farm chores. It was getting dark by the time we got done. During the war years, 1941 to 1945, you could not buy much of anything. Most everything was rationed. The car factories were all shut down because of the shortage of steel, and no new cars were being built. So after the war ended in 1945, things started to move again. My dad had his name on a list for a new car at the car dealership in Fessenden, North Dakota. So one day a car came down the road to our farm, and we didn't know who it was because it was a brand new car. I think it was a Studebaker. Well, it was my Uncle John G. Kleinsaucer driving this car. His wife was my mom's sister, and he was our country preacher for about 40 years. My dad asked him how he got that new car, and Uncle John said that he had his name on the list at the dealer. So my dad looked at him and said, well, I had my name on the list too, so how come you got the car? As it happened, there were 4 John Kleinsaucers living in the same area, but they all had different middle initials for their middle names. Uncle John G. was the first one to walk into the dealership and say he was John Kleinsaucer, so they sold him the car. And afterwards, my folks said it was for the best because they could not afford to buy a new car anyway. Sometimes on Sundays, my uncle and aunt would come and pick us up with their new car, and we would go visit a neighbor or go to a gathering somewhere. Where we lived, all the pastures were fenced, and you had to stop and open the gate to drive through. I was usually the one to get out and open the gate. Uncle John would always shut off the motor until I had the gate open. Then he would drive through, then shut off the motor again until I had the gate closed. So one day I asked him, why do you shut off the motor and start it up again just to drive through the gate? His reply was, to save gas. So I thought to myself that it will cost more to replace the car starter than he saves in gas. But as everyone knew, Uncle John and Aunt Katie were real conservative. Having been through bad times made most folks that way. Living through the Depression years was hard for everyone. If you had food to eat and a place to sleep, you were considered very fortunate.
That family farm was near Chaseley, North Dakota, on land homesteaded by Allen's grandfather, who emigrated from Russia. Allen's collection of essays appears in two volumes, Memories of Dakota Jack, 1935 to 1956, and 50 Years of Family Memories, 1957 to 2007. Allen Jack Kleinsasser currently lives in Rapid City. Natural North Dakota is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Insurance, helping to preserve peace of mind and independence with home, auto, life, and long-term care insurance solutions. Learn more at Bremer.com. Bremer Insurance, for what's ahead.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Who has spring fever? Well, there's meteorological spring, astronomical spring, and then there's what most people actually care about, if the temperatures are going up. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura goes into the science behind the season.
Are you ready for spring? The calendar says it'll start next Tuesday, the 20th. Now, if the weather cooperates, we'll be in business. The first day of spring, of course, coincides with the spring equinox, sometimes called the vernal equinox. As the name implies, equa, equal, and nox, night, the lengths of the nighttime and daytime on the equinox will be close to equal around the globe. The spring equinox, along with the fall or autumnal equinox, marks the time of the year when the sun is directly overhead on the equator. But that's not for all day. It'll occur on the 20th at precisely 16:15 Universal Time, which is 10:15 a.m. Central Time. After the spring equinox, our days will lengthen until the summer solstice in June, marking the first day of summer. Then our days will shorten until the fall or autumnal equinox in September. The days continue to shorten, of course, until the first day of winter or the winter solstice in December. It's all because the Earth does not spin on an axis that's perpendicular to the orbit. If that were the case, we wouldn't have the seasons, and the sun would always be directly overhead of the equator. The Earth's angle of rotation is tilted 23.5 degrees off perpendicular. Have you ever wondered why? Apparently, there's been a collision or collisions. The leading hypothesis is that back after the Big Bang, when the planets in our solar system were forming, a lot of material would have been flying around. Some of that material coalesced to form the planets of our solar system. Larger masses would have produced greater gravitational attraction than smaller ones. It's hypothesized that at some point there was a collision, or perhaps many collisions, involving the Earth that knocked the Earth off its axis. The distribution of the mass of the Earth is also a factor. Based on what I've read, the Earth is a little top-heavy due to the polar ice, and that's not equally distributed up there. So the Earth is tilted, and we have our four seasons. But what would life on Earth be like if it were tilted 35 degrees, 45 degrees? It would be different. So maybe 23.5 degrees isn't so bad. Happy spring equinox. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, Harvest Public Media looks at lab-grown protein. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's Pipeline Authority director says recent trends point toward North Dakota seeing its natural gas production exceeding its processing capacity, a capability. Justin Kringstead says production levels held near steady in December and January, and the real crunch could develop during the upcoming summer months. He says new natural gas processing facilities are being developed, but there are still questions over how much can be processed and how much would be flared off. He says there are similar questions when it comes to transporting crude oil by pipeline as opposed to rail.
So North Dakota saw a large increase in our ability to move crude oil by pipeline last summer when Dakota Access went online. However, that additional capacity, in my estimates, is expected to be exceeded again by production within the next 12 to 18 months.
Kringstead says at that point, the additional overcapacity barrels would be forced onto the railroad network unless there is some form of pipeline expansion. Fargo City Commissioners discussed the revised FM diversion plan last night, with the main topic the expected increase in the cost of the new plan. Early estimates put the new price tag at $2.4 billion. That's up at least $200 million, but some commissioners expect that estimate will be even higher. Commissioner Tony Grinberg is on the Financial Committee, which is going to work looking for additional funding.
My personal opinion is the federal government needs to step up above $450 million for our region, and then we have the state. And so is there a fair request of what number that will be to the state, to the Water Resources Trust Fund? And thankfully, the oil now is over $60 a barrel, and that trust fund is going to grow again. So over the next 60 days, I believe we'll have a better feel what that number is, and then start to put a plan together to address that.
The Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney says Minnesota has included additional dollars in the governor's bonding bill, up from $43 million already allocated. He says that will help.
The new cost changes will probably be an additional 50, so that should be $93 million. We have assurances by Governor Dayton that they will cover Minnesota costs. So whatever part of the project that's in Minnesota, they have told us that they would cover that cost.
Diversion backers must still get approval from the Minnesota DNR to get the project on track. They will submit a permit application for the revised proposal to Minnesota later this month. The DNR denied the original permit because it would have impacted Minnesota heavily and provided most of the benefits on the North Dakota side of the river. And a Minot lawmaker wants to require people running in local elections to identify their party affiliations. Republican Representative Scott Lauser says it would affect city, county, school board, and other local races. Lauser says he tried to get the idea as an amendment during the 2017 session, but that was rejected, so he plans to introduce it as a standalone bill in the 2019 legislature.
When we have people that are getting elected at the local level and candidates don't have to declare a party, and there isn't really an opportunity for, in many cases, voters to find out who they're electing, it was just something that I thought of last session. It was a little bit late into the session. The amendment didn't get accepted by the Senate committee, and introduce it as a bill this time and see where it goes.
Lauser says opponents may claim this bill will discourage people from running in local elections, but he says he thinks it will actually encourage people to run. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Grammy winner Fantastic Negrito.
Ain't good enough.
Spellbinding singer from Duluth, Galen Lee. And in-demand festival band Tank and the Bangas. What do they have in common? Well, they were the first three winners of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. Attention, prairie musicians. It's time to hone your chops and enter the 2018 NPR Tiny Desk Contest. The winning band will perform in front of NPR's iconic Tiny Desk in D.C., tour the U.S. with NPR and contest sponsor Lagunitas, and appear on NPR's quiz show Ask Me Another.
Hello, everyone in this office!
Create a new video showing your band performing an original song in front of the tiny desk of your choice. Then upload the clip onto YouTube. The winner will be chosen by a panel of judges, including Sylvanesso, Gabby Moreno, and Bob Boylan of All Songs Considered.
The winner of the Tiny Desk Contest is...
Entry forms must be in by 11 p.m. Central, March 25th at tinydeskcontest.npr.org. So, gotta practice, dust off that desk, and get to work.
No time for
And then enter NPR's 2018 Tiny Desk Contest.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. When two big meat companies, Tyson and Cargill, recently invested in a lab-grown protein startup, some said Americans' love affair with meat had cooled. Actually, it's proven quite the opposite. The U.S. is expected to eat a record amount of red meat and poultry this year. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports that the reasons are both healthy and not so healthy.
Here in Kansas City, one of the newer restaurants downtown is called Protein House. Alexander Minelli just had a Greek bowl delivered to his table.
So it's a turkey burger with brown rice, some low-fat feta cheese, like a salad, but it's a Mediterranean salad because you can see there's olives.
Minelli is a bodybuilder and says he came to Protein House because he eats what he calls clean food, like turkey produced without antibiotics. He and other healthy eaters are helping drive record meat consumption. The U.S. Agriculture Department estimates that each one of us, on average, will consume more than 220 pounds of beef, pork, chicken, or turkey this year.
We are a nation of protein eaters.
David Portalatin is an analyst with NPD Group, a global firm that tracks consumer behavior. He says 56% of consumers named protein as the top nutrient they are looking to add to their diet. Portalatin via Skype says there's no one big fad diet right now, though most are eating something low carb, like paleo or keto diets. He says American adults are embracing a very personalized sense of health.
Among consumers that tell us that they are following a specific diet, the most popular diet in America today is simply one of my own making.
His research shows that consumers don't really like typical diet definitions either. Take a guy like Thomas Donnelly, who was waiting for his lunch at Protein House. He ordered a hummus wrap, as he says he mostly stays away from meat, sort of.
I typically do, but then I'll go have barbecue on the weekends every now and then.
Donnelly says he doesn't like labels like vegetarian or flexitarian. Those are folks who eat mostly vegetables with some meat thrown in. That makes sense to David Sprinkle, a food market researcher with a company called Packaged Facts.
A confusing thing about consumer food trends is that conflicting trends are always at work. Often within the same individual and over the course of the same day.
Although there's lots of talk of vegetarian or vegan diets, Sprinkle says not many people actually follow them. The meat movement, Sprinkle sees, is much more towards traditional and not real healthy dishes.
There is a real celebration of meat of all types. And we've seen that with the pork craze, you know, pulled pork sandwiches, the bacon craze. We're seeing bacon, you know, in our candy bars.
The other big trends are big calorie dishes like gourmet burgers, fried chicken, beef short ribs, and charcuterie. And that's found from high-end restaurants to fast food places.
Somewhere underneath all that bacony, bourbony, crispy oniony goodness, there's a turkey having the best day of his entire life.
Arby's, we have the meat.
And there's another factor at play. U.S. supplies of red meat and chicken are at record highs, thanks to a grain glut, so prices at the grocery store are low. And the more cheap meat, the more you eat. The USDA recommends that adults eat 5 to 6 ounces of protein daily, but it also forecasts we'll consume double that every single day this year. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is a sure sign of spring, horticulturist Ron Smith. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, and it's just that the signs of spring are definitely showing outside with bright sunshine and melting snow.
I saw a lot of melt.
Yes, and it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah.
So there's hope yet.
There is. Well, do we need to talk about some potential damage, though, that could have happened over the winter? Are we already able to assess that and do anything about it?
Some of it. Of course, if you're living in the Fargo-Moorhead area, you're going to say, I'm crazy to go out and check your plants today or even maybe the rest of this week, depending on how fast the snow melts. But there's bound to be some damage. You're going to find maybe branches on shrubs bent down flat due to the weight of the snow, maybe some branches that had broken or snapped on your trees, your weaker trees like silver maples will have bent. Any Lombardy poplars out there will have that same kind of an impact. Willows, you might see some damage on them. But you don't have to jump right on it to go ahead and try to take care of it while there's still snow on the ground. But just make a mental note that that's something that needs to be addressed before the new growth begins this spring.
Any cause for concern? I mean, a lot of times you want snow because of the insulating effects, mm-hmm. and it seemed to me that we got kind of a late jump at the snow level here, that we mm-hmm. got the cold temperatures without mm-hmm. the insulating properties
yeah.
of the snow.
Yeah, yeah, and there's bound to be some injury, some damage, even to some of the hardiest plants, depending on the care and their microclimate location, the soil types, how well the soils drain, so on and so on and so on. So it's just one of those things that you need to be aware of that even though it won't show right now, get your mind set to look for the ones that are typically in a very vulnerable position, open exposure, areas on your property where you've had historically poor drainage, where you've had high winds that could desiccate plant material like some of your evergreens. Evergreens like arborvitae and junipers would be the most vulnerable that you would be seeing some possible winter windburn damage taking place without the insulating effect of the snow.
Mm-hmm. And then anything we can do about it or
not
just
really.
Clean it up?
I remember many, many, many years ago when I was active with the Extension Service, we had a very bad winter. It was in the early 90s. And it was around this time of year where we had a heavy snow, and then we had it covered a lot of things in cold temperatures. And then we had it's a wind that dries. It's warmer than normal, and it melts the snow like mad. And, of course, the ground is still frozen, and it sucks the moisture out of evergreens. And so we saw a lot of evergreens with winter burn on it. And I remember Dave DeCock and I thought, oh, boy, we're going to have a lot of winter evergreen damage this year. Lo and behold, a lot of the plants, most of the plants recovered. It was just like a bad sunburn for them, and they were able to go ahead and regenerate tissue and look halfway decent. Of course, some of them did die outright, and those you have to go ahead and remove. But it's not as bad as it appears at first, so don't jump the gun and say, I got to rip this thing out and go ahead and buy a new plant to replace it. The nurseries would love it, but
sure,
you know, be realistic about it as well. So,
mm-hmm. How about any pruning?
Any pruning, yes. If you can get out and when it makes good sense to get out and start doing some pruning, go ahead and do so if you can reach what needs to be pruned with both feet on the ground. I know someone like you, a little bit acrobatic, living on the edge a little bit every now and then, and you blush very nicely. It's not a good idea to try to take chances on getting up on a stepladder to get that branch pruned back. If you have,
but you're holding something sharp. Come on, it's so much fun.
Yeah, and of course, make sure you have good pruning tools to do it. If you do, and if you don't, hire an arborist, professional arborist, to come out and do it. These guys and gals do it every day, so it's just like a piece of cake for them to go ahead and get something like this done.
Are we talking trees only or particularly woody plants too?
Mostly trees. It's hard to find the arborists out there. If there might be some out there, and if there are, I would love to know who they are, that will come out and prune your shrubs for you, your woody plant shrubs. Most of them are more interested in tree pruning because it's a major undertaking that most homeowners can't properly pursue. And again, most homeowners have tools at their disposal that they can go ahead and lollipop their woody plants as much as they want to.
Lollipop them?
Yes, yes. What? Make them all look the same with these electric pruning
shears. That's what you call that, lollipopping?
Yeah. Yes, McDonaldizing or lollipopping. Making everything look the same.
We're franchising here.
Okay.
We're visiting with horticulturist Ron Smith. He joins us periodically during the growing season, or in this case, right in advance of the main growing season.
I'm being optimistic. Here. It's going to come fast.
Well, there's work to be done here.
Yeah.
Can we start some seeds already?
Yeah, some of your seeds, and I'm using my wife as a good example. She started her geranium seeds about a month or so ago, and they're up growing beautifully right now. So when the time and temperature become right, they will be beautiful plants to go ahead and set out because they're probably about 3 to 4 inches tall right now. And so that's just great. You can go ahead and start tomatoes and peppers as well. This is be a good time because in about 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to be setting them out. And that would be anywhere from the middle of May to the end of May. And a lot of people like to use that drop-dead date of Memorial Day weekend to actually do some safe planting of their annuals. And if you want to go by that, that's fine. But back up the time you need to go ahead and get those seeds started. And then it all depends on what kind of facilities you have available to start the seedlings. Bottom heat, you can buy mats that have bottom heat that's temperature controlled that will get the temperature, soil temperature, up to around 78 to 80 degrees. And the seedlings love that. They will develop wonderful seeds. But then at the same time, you have to have good light overhead, and something more than just a fluorescent light in the ceiling, but a light that you can lower down close to just a few inches above the plant, and that would be a plant light that would have a spectrum very close to that of the sun, and the plants will pop and grow, and once you see them growing and getting their first true leaves on beyond the cotyledons, then you can turn off the bottom heat because that root system will have been extensively developed. And what you want to do then is grow them slowly and develop a hardiness to them. You don't want them soft and succulent because they won't survive being planted outside.
Do you have strong feelings about the whatever the container is? Like, are you okay with the plastic ones and then you just pop out the soil and put them in there? Or do you feel strongly that they should be in a container that itself can be planted?
Well, based on the experience that I've had when I was working with Extension and doing a lot of transplanting outside, we found that the best thing to go ahead and do would be to pop them out of the little starting trays so you can pop them out very easily with your thumb. Take the plant, the little ball of a rooted ball of plant, stick it in the ground, put the soil around it, and go on. That works a lot better for us when you have a lot of plants to put in the ground than a one that has this the roots growing into this media, and I'm talking about artificial media. And what we have found that lots of times they'll just stay right within that little artificial media and not grow out into the surrounding area. So if you can get what they would call good potting soil to go ahead and move your little seedling transplants into to pop out at the 6 to 8 week time period, bingo, you'll have a much better chance of getting a full-grown plant established.
Well, my boss, Bill Thomas, stopped in. He is quite a passionate gardener, and he has a question for you.
Yeah. Well, Ron, you know I do vegetable gardening and leeks. I like leeks.
Oh.
But I wanted to start them from seed, and in the past I've started them around the same time I started tomatoes and stuff, and they were really tiny. So this year I thought I'll start them really early. And I started them in early January, and well, first of all, they sprouted and they came up, and then it just seemed like they've been going really slow. So is that okay? Is that normal? And then, you know, a good thing to do sometimes with tomatoes and stuff is when they're still a seedling, transplant them to a different seedling pot, and then that seems to help them do better. Does that work with leeks, too?
It probably would if they're still in the original container. Lots of times, and I'm not going to profess expertise on leeks because I've never grown them, but from what I've understood in talking to other gardeners like yourself, yeah, they do take their time getting started, but then once they kick their growth into gear, whether it's day length or light intensity or whatever it happens to be, that pushes them on, and it's probably one of those that light has something to do with light intensity and day length as well. You'll get much better growth. But are they past the cotyledon stage?
Yes.
Okay, then go ahead and transplant them into another container that you can go ahead and transplant them from that into the garden, and then you might be seeing some better growth taking place.
Okay.
So give it a try.
Yeah, no, I got a whole bunch of them in the tray, so I'm hopeful.
Okay. Oh, good luck. Handle them carefully.
All right. Okay, thanks.
I'm excited to be invited to that dinner party. Just putting that out there.
Lots
of leaks. Do we want to be fertilizing right now? I know that some fertilizers out there come at a 4 year or a four times a year.
Yes.
Calendar here.
I am aware of that, and as a former salesman, I'd say, oh yes, this is a wonderful time to go ahead and buy your fertilizer. If you have good sale prices on fertilizer now, that you probably won't see any better later on in the year, by all means, go ahead and get out there and buy that fertilizer. But don't put it on the plant until you see some active growth. What a lot of people do is once the snow disappears and the frost is out of the ground and the plants are still dormant, they throw a bunch of fertilizer down and say, there, I've done it. Well, you know, it's like your mother saying, you ate all of your dinner, now you eat your dessert. Mom, I'm too full for my dessert. No, this is good dessert that I made. It's good for you. And, you know, the word good for
what you kind of turns... What conversation have you ever had with a kid who said, I'm too full for dessert?
I'm making this up, of course. This is a fable, you know.
Oh, this is one of those lesson learning stories.
Anyway, it's not going to do the plant any good. In fact, it might inhibit the plant to grow normally because they've stored all their own food that they need for spring growth late last summer and the fall. And so they're going to have all that energy stored within their plant tissue to go ahead and pop and grow. Mm-hmm. So if you have branches that are dead, limbs that are dead, throwing fertilizer on them is not going to resurrect them. Simply cut those out. If the whole plant is dead, throwing fertilizer on it is not going to resurrect them. Pull the plant out and consider replanting. So simple as that.
Okay. We're visiting with horticulturist Ron Smith. We are getting some late winter, early spring gardening tips. And one, you've given me a list of tips here, and one of these has bold letters. Plant damage assessment is cursory at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's just something that you kind of walk around when you can. Of course, our backyard, I don't know about yours, Ashley, I'm sure it is, since you live in Moorhead, you have a lot of snow.
There's
on the ground.
There's lots of snow in there,
and
yeah.
The heck with tromping through that to see what's going on back there in the back 40. So I'll just wait until that snow disappears, and then we can go ahead and check out what the damage has been done.
It's so hard, though, when you have spring fever.
Yes, I know. I agree. I agree. You know, one of the things we found out this last year, we have rabbits that love to gnaw on our woody plant shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife and I very industriously put up a plastic fence around our woody plants that we are trying to get to go to a decent size. And so we put it up all around the whole thing, you know, made sure it was secure to the ground and everything else. Guess what happened? The rabbits have eaten through that to get into those things. And so plastic fencing does not keep rabbits out. Keep that in mind, folks, if you're thinking about putting plastic fencing up. So if these plants come back again this year, next fall, we're going to put chicken wire or rabbit-proof fencing around it. It's going to be a wire. And if a rabbit can chew
or
through that, then they can have whatever they want. I'm not going to fight them anymore.
We have St. Patrick's Day right around the corner. Mm-hmm. I know it's not like Christmas where you're given lots of poinsettias
green beer
Valentine's Day where you get lots of flowers sometimes. But are there some sort of
shamrocks are popular. They're the most popular plant to go ahead and give. They have a, good growers will try to get shamrock varieties that will have four. It's a little clover-type plant. And if you find one with four leaves on it, that's your lucky plant. And, of course, that's the shamrock. And they can grow very easily in the house as a house plant up to a point. Generally, people overwater them. They're considered oxalis. The oxalis species will grow in the shade and the moisture out in the landscape as a weed. Okay. And then once the hot, dry weather sets, it goes dormant and goes to seed. So I don't suggest planting this outside after you nurse it through the remaining weeks of the winter and the early spring. Just go ahead and dump it and buy a new one next year. Admire it while it's there. If you want to keep it in bloom, it's the little white flowers that they have. Pick off the flowers as they start to fade. Then you'll keep getting it blooming more and more, more and more. And then once the plant just starts to go dormant, then just go ahead and dump it because you have greater things to do outside. Then the other thing to do is if you like green, and we all do because we've seen so much white this winter, get some Bells of Ireland seed. I don't think you're going to see it in the supermarkets, so you're going to probably have to buy the Bells of Ireland or the garden seed displays. If you do, buy some. But go ahead and get it started right away to plant outside. Now, this is one of these little seedlings that you're better off minimally disturbing the roots. So if you can plant it into the seed, into the final container that you're going to be popping out of the ground and putting into, or popping out of that container and putting into the ground, that's the one to use because the roots don't like to be disturbed. So Bells of Ireland, you'll have it all summer long.
All right. If you have a question for Ron Smith, you can always send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Cable One High-Speed Internet, designed to offer a streaming connection that allows customers to watch movies and videos without buffering or interruption. More information at 1-855-CABLE-1.
Next time on Studio 360, Olympic athlete Kevin Hall has a mental illness called the Truman Show delusion.
And everybody's in on it.
The Kevin Show, next time on Studio 360.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for March 13th.
Dakota's territorial lawmakers convened in Bismarck in January of 1885. It was the first legislative session after the territory's capital was yanked from Yankton. By a Capital Commission's 5-4 vote in 1883, Yankton lost the seat of government, and that led to backlash, including court battles and the removal of Governor Nehemiah Ordway. Still, Bismarck kept the capital, and Dakota's 16th legislative session got underway with swearings in and electing legislative officers like Sergeant-at-Arms, Chaplain, and Speaker of the House. The territorial legislature included 24 council members and 48 House representatives. Bismarck Mayor John P. Dunn extended a hearty welcome to Governor Gilbert A. Pierce and invited lawmakers to a reception at the new Capitol building. Legislative business covered a variety of topics, from establishing three counties in what would become North Dakota to a House bill granting women suffrage. Governor Pierce vetoed the bill. In a letter to the Speaker of the House, the governor said that full women's suffrage will delay our claims to statehood. Later, in 1885, Dakota's legislature and Indiana Senator Benjamin Harrison would make efforts for Congress to split the territory, giving statehood to South Dakota and reorganize Northern Dakota Territory. Pierce also wrote that Dakota women should have a voice in determining suffrage and that territorial suffrage would conflict with city charters in Southern Dakota that allowed only male voters. If women are to be enfranchised, let it be done not as a 30 days wonder, but as a merited reform resulting from mature reflection approved by the public conscience and sanctioned by the enlightened judgment of the people. Pierce wrote on this date in 1885, the same day the legislature adjourned, sine die. Full women's suffrage in North Dakota would have to wait until the National Amendment was passed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
The firing of Rex Tillerson took most people by surprise. People in his own office learned he was out when journalists called for comment. President Trump, however, said the writing was on the wall.
Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things.
More on the shakeup on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with Kirsten Baszler, the North Dakota Superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction, and she joins us to talk about a number of issues and opportunities when it comes to education in the state. And we continue the education theme with EdCamp North Dakota. This is a professional development opportunity for educators with a unique twist. It's the participants who decide what they're going to talk about, not the presenters. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.